Cinnabar Moss, or any kind of moth you'd like to be. Welcome to the Writer's Triangle, Cinnabar Moss podcast about all things publishing and books. Today we are here with Robert Creekmore of the Prophet's Death Trilogy. Book 2, Prophet's Lamentation, is our July release. Robert, how are you doing today?
Most excellent, sir. Most excellent.
Prophet's Death has Naomi as it sets the experience of her when she doesn't have the power to fight back and the eventual gaining of the power to fight back and that journey and that difficult process. Whereas Prophet's Lamentation, she starts off with, I already developed the skills, the knowledge, the strength, and also the magical powers to be able to kill some motherfuckers and need killing.
Right. And that's in the second. Okay. That's in the second paragraph, some motherfuckers ain't killing. But I, you probably don't remember, but a year ago when we did our last interview, we talked about how I got the book contract, and we were talking about CW and I having that interaction. And I said the moral of the book is some motherfuckers need killing. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got the press to read it. That's why they were like, yeah, we don't want to look at that.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it's a little shout out to that interaction and for the press to use that at the beginning of the second book.
I think it's a really raw line. And, you know, Kistra, of course, agrees, and that is part of what drew us into being interested, because that is actually just true from our points of view. And it ties into the story and it makes sense, right? It's not just thrown in there for gratuitous violence. It has a basis for it. And right. With this experience, we're looking at Naomi has developed skills for her skills to fight back and everything. And part of those skills is, of course, the magic, or for lack of a better word, the magic, the superpowers that she has.
I call it abilities.
Abilities, yeah.
And I want to say something. I think there's a big that. Okay, so that's obviously a big trope nowadays, and I think it always has been. I want to give my opinion of why people like that, and why it's not something that should just be dismissed. Most of us have no power whatsoever. Correct. I mean, I have next to no power in this world. What happens, happens. Just like I said earlier with the AI, if it comes, it comes. I can't do anything about it. When we want to fight back against those who hurt us, but we can't. Whether it be political power, whether it be physical power, when you see someone come from the, you know, from the weak and the discarded gain power and use it to right things, it is cathartic for the reader or the viewer or whatever it is that you're, you know, absorbing. And that's why I just wanted to say that, because I think I get a little bit of flack from people like, well, you know, how many people are going to have, you know, mythological powers? Well, that's why people like that.
Yeah, anyway. I definitely agree that there is a sense of catharsis seeing people get their comeuppance that deserve it, right?
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's nice, for lack of a better phrasing.
And you can't do it legally in the real world, so.
Yeah.
There's
limits.
Of course, and I don't encourage anyone to emulate my books. They're just books, but this allows me to do it without it being a problem.
Yeah. That there is a place for that, and that place is in fiction, you know?
That's right.
And so going into Prophet's Lamentation with Naomi having these powers, right? It's something that is your the powers that you describe and kind of the abilities that she develops are rather unique from my perspective and looking at other mythology and other things that I've read and such. And so I wanted to ask you a little bit, where did the indigo and the spiritual guide Theta and this alternate dimension and everything, what are you drawing from to create this system and to create these powers? How did you come up with them?
Ketamine?
What was that?
Ketamine. Ketamine.
Oh,
the drug.
Okay.
The drug ketamine.
Yeah.
Yes. So I'm have a real serious depression issue. Like I've been hospitalized for a few times, and one of the treatments is ketamine.
Okay.
So yeah. So I use ketamine on a regular basis in a doctor's office with a doctor, making sure I'm safe. This is legal. But also, while I was using a lot of ketamine, I started listening to this podcast called Closer to Truth, which is by Robert Lawrence Kuhn. And he's a physicist or neuropsych. I can't remember. He's I think he's a neuropsych. And so his podcast and show is all about the nature of consciousness and cosmology. So, it's a philosophy show kind of combined with a science show. So he has on philosophers, writers, astronomers, the hard science people. This isn't like crystals and hippy dippy stuff. I find it very interesting, although it's a little dry and bland. So, of course, none of that stuff is in Robert Lawrence Kuhn's show. It's just that he started making me think about it quite a bit. And the process of being on ketamine off and on while, listening to these, astronomers and psychiatrists and other types of scientists talk about the nature of consciousness and the observer effect and things of that nature, it really kind of started me thinking about creating a new mythology. So I'm really not drawing from anywhere per se. I just really kind of made it up from scratch. I know a lot of people use established mythological characters like vampires, werewolves, stuff like that, and that's fine. But I want to be original. So I thought, okay, let me come up with something very specific. And their world, basically, like, there are three layers, like a cake. Our world is one. Our universe is one. There's a Woods of Lamentation. And then there is Seraphiria. The Seraphirian are time minders, essentially is what I call them. But really what they're responsible for is keeping the equation of reality in equilibrium. And there are 12 of them, just like there are 12 apostles. There's a lot of biblical mythology in my work because that's what I grew up in. I'm definitely not religious now. But I draw on that experience. So I guess there's somewhere I drew from. And in their world, it's just the 12 of them, and time is one painting. It's the fourth dimension, and they are looking at it and making sure that everything stays in sync. Everything works, and each one is responsible for one thing or another thing. So Theta, for example, is responsible for weather. And Freda is responsible for conscious thought and correcting issues with that. And I don't mean individual issues, just like overall and the evolution of it. And then there was this one named Zelia. Zelia is the only one that ever left and came to the human world. Each one of them has one of 12 lights in them. And those celestial type of lights allow them to basically be demigods and to affect the thing that they need to affect to the smallest nudge and degree that it needs to be affected to make sure it stays on point.
Right.
Well, Zelia wanted to have a daughter. Well, she wanted to have two daughters, actually, and she could do that. There, she's not allowed, and she wanted to live in time linearly. So she came here. She eventually passed away. She passed away in the cave where Naomi escaped And so Zelia's light remained there in stasis after her death hundreds of years before. And this is a holy site for the Seraphirion, even though they don't visit because they can't. When Charles died, basically, I used the method in the Talmud for creating, which is a Jewish proto-text to the Bible, to creating a golem, which is a soulless form, which is essentially like a it's a story that people would tell about this scary monster that protected the village and to kind of scare the people that might attack the village, right? So I tell that entire basically that ritual happens in happenstance, and Naomi ends up absorbing that light, and simultaneously a golem is created, which is the Mara character. Now she's not just a golem, she's a product of the Woods of Lamentation. And what the Woods of Lamentation are, which is and the other world, is it's not exactly hell, but it is a punishment. And it's for those who do the most atrocious things that you could possibly imagine. They end up there, child rapists, things of that nature. And the creatures there are always hungry. That was one of the creatures you saw coming and picking up the marine and running off with them into the woods. Now, these two worlds in representation, where when Naomi sees them, are two. There's a train track that represents our world, and there's on one side the Woods of Lamentation, on the other side, through the woods and in the wood line is Seraphiria. So in the Woods of Lamentation, these creatures roam constantly, eat these men, some women, mostly men, and tear them apart, defecate them out, then they reform, only to be hunted and killed again and again and again. And that's their natural stasis. That's a natural order of things because that's what they had coming. But those creatures are mindless, they're all golem. Well, Mara, she is the one who actually, well, she's the one that actually had the light. The light form was absorbed into Mara. I'm sorry, I was wrong. She ended up gifting it to Naomi at the end because she wasn't old enough to and mature enough to hang on to it and use it. I really screwed the pooch by messing up my own book retelling, didn't I?
I think that it's fine.
Anyway, so those golem completely roam and do and kill. And that ceremony allowed one to be created that was like the ones in the Woods of Lamentation, but to also harbor and store this light and this power for Naomi when she is mature enough, when she can wield it responsibly or wield it at all, because it's not something that's easy to wield. And watch her grow, and she's a stopgap to make sure Naomi makes it down her path and continues forward to do the things that she's got to do, even though those things are hard. And I don't just mean going to college. I mean eliminating people that need to be eliminated and knowing full well that she's going to have a very difficult life in the ensuing years. So that's that world, and of course then that's the other world in any way, and we're somewhere in the middle. I know, it's
And
weird.
so with that, it's sort of three separate worlds layered on top of each other that they can interact a bit, but they never truly fully intersect with each other.
That's right. Now the train tracks represent time. Our world is represented by means of travel, and it depends on who, and really only Naomi's ever been there. But if Naomi had been a different person in this middle world, this representation between the two, it could have looked like a river. It could have looked like a horse and carriage and a dirt trail. It is a form of transportation. It's a form of transportation that super familiar with it. It's consistent and stays on one, you know, area and never leaves it, because the entirety of their system works on time in our world, clicking forward and clicking forward. And those are the gears of reality for, you know, the entire universe, whether it be our universe or the other two layers of the universe. And it is their job, the Seraphirion, to make sure that clock keeps ticking the way it's supposed to tick. Of course, with Naomi being, you know, in the situation Naomi's in, a lot of them aren't necessarily happy with it, because she is kind of a remainder, as I call it. Every time the equation, it's like long division, you know, there's a remainder, and it keeps, and it's right. This endless equation's constantly seeking perfection. And there's a lot of animosity and also help and showing that those Seraphirion aren't this monolith of demigods. They all have their own opinions, their own ideas, and how things are going to work out. So, you know, she kind of is in the middle of a lot of stuff that she didn't create, but now she has to deal with and solve.
And so with Naomi's experience, it's she's in a sense thrust into, by circumstance, a series of roles that she then plays. And the way that it plays out for her exactly is unique to her, and but the reality is that things outside of her control led to her being in the position that she's in, and then she moves forward from there, and she has to interact with these things that are otherworldly.
Yes, they're otherworldly, and they're not omniscient. There's really no, it's a world that's more of like a deist kind of world, where essentially there's a kind of not interested God that set everything in motion, is the way I guess I would put it. I don't say that in the book, but that's kind of my view on how this world, you know, their world works, is that, you know, it's a non interested God that did it as a project. You're like, eh.
You put it in motion, now it's good. I moved on.
And that's why those creatures exist. They're there to monitor it and keep it working.
And so with this, with Prophet's Debt and with Prophet's Lamentation, each of them, I feel, has had a trajectory of, you know, circumstances and things that have been talked about in each book that's kind of, as you mentioned, different from each other, right? You mentioned that Prophet's Lamentation is meant to be a standalone, be able to be read as a book by itself, even though with Prophet's Debt you'd have a lot more understanding and a lot more context for what's going on with Naomi. That's not necessary to read it for Prophet's Lamentation, right?
That's right. It's definitely not necessary.
And with that, I think that you also have sort of separate messaging that I get from Prophet's Debt versus Prophet's Lamentation, where in Prophet's Debt, you know, it shines light on the horrors of conversion therapy, the condition of those types of camps, and the experiences involved with these horrific things, but also the healing that can be found and the positivity of finding people that you can connect with and found family and having ties to people, and that kind of the positive side of finding people that are like-minded and that can care about you and that you have that mutual trust and connection to, even if the people that you aren't family by blood.
That's right.
And then Prophet's Lamentation, I feel like it shines a bit more of an active light on homophobia and the lives of consenting adults and the nuance of those relationships and how relationships aren't quite, as you mentioned earlier, as binary as people mm-hmm. might like to view them. Are these messagings and are these things intentional? Did you go into writing these books with the intent of talking about them actively, or was it just a case of you're writing the story and this is what came about?
You know, I think what I write is, you know, what was I thinking about that day? And then, you know, there's bits of each day and, you know, on it every, like, because you know, I'll write a few pages a day. And sometimes a broader theme comes out and, you know, it's kind of based on what my experience was at the time, or not even necessarily experience, but what was I thinking about? I did go into them with kind of those ideas, and I think in the, well, definitely with the conversion therapy thing, and it definitely was intentional, and talking about the found family was definitely intentional, and I expand that because family is not just blood; it can be you can have wonderful family members, and you can have abusive family members, but family is who you make it. And I think a lot of people have to make their own family and want to normalize that. But yeah, the thing about this story is the genesis of why Naomi's in this position is her sexuality. Well, it's the response of others to her sexuality when she was young. It's not her sexuality isn't the cause, but it's the response of others. But my dated, like, I have her living a life that it wouldn't matter. It's just incidental, the fact that Naomi is a lesbian. And I kind of wanted that to be the case in this book. She could be anyone. She could be a man. She could be non-binary. She could be a straight woman. It's all about love and protecting what you love and who you love. And yeah, she doesn't, just like I don't wake up every morning and go, oh yeah, I'm autistic. You know, people don't wake up in the morning and go, oh yeah, I'm straight, or oh yeah, I'm gay. Nobody does that. You just live your damn life. And that's what I tried to go forth with, showing her as this shell-shocked soldier, and her having sort of drinking issues and some marital problems, all relatable to anyone, really. And then I show like Herschel and Nate, best friends from college. Nate is gay, Herschel's straight. Herschel and Nate do have a relationship, not a sexual relationship. They sleep in the same bed together, they cuddle, but they are not compatible in that way. But they do love each other. And I kind of wanted to show these kind of relationships that do exist, but are taboo, you know, but are really healthy in a lot of ways. And so, yeah, I just kind of show people living their day-to-day lives and then reacting to what happens. And at this point, their sexuality doesn't matter. But of course, the point is, as you see them living their lives, just like people who are straight or, you know, would be living their lives, that it is just fucking incidental. You know, showing them living their incidental lives, their lives shows that their sexuality is just completely, utterly incidental, and their lives are their lives. So that, you know, and that does come back to the homophobia, where it comes to, like, you know, in the lives of consenting adults and things like that, you know, like with people sticking their fucking nose in other people's business. And sometimes I feel like I wish that, I think the closer you can get to someone in a friendly way, and show them that everyone is basically the same in a lot of ways,
Yeah.
And show them the things that what they've made up in their mind to be afraid of or to hate. You know, if they could just see other people living the way that they live, then they might be able to drop some of that hate. I don't know. Hopefully I did that.
I think that you did a wonderful job representing these people and their relationships and their lives in a way that is authentic. In terms of, like, for example, the relationship between Herschel and Nate, right? And yeah, them being, you know, platonic, but them loving each other and that bond and connection between two people that is beautiful and deserves celebration. And like you mentioned, doesn't really get talked about a lot or is seen as strange or unusual. And I feel like the only reason it's unusual for a lot of people is just the lack of exposure to it rather than it actually being this super uncommon thing.
The lack of exposure comes from fear. Because why, if you were to expose someone to your reality and they hated you and might possibly make your life worse for it, whether that be social consequences or physical consequences, you're going to keep it to yourself. And
of course,
and I think you'll be a bit diminished for it because, I mean, not your fault, but to some degree, your life is diminished when you can't live out who you are, you know? So if you're not out, they can't be out, there are a lot of people who can't be out, then I think your life has lost a little of the shine that it could have had. So I try to normalize that kind of thing too. You know, it's, love is a multifaceted thing, and it doesn't always include sex.
For sure, definitely. And moving through that, you know, the experiences of your light being diminished and, you know, that often coming with fear, being a fear of, for example, threat of violence in particular, right? And persecution, things of that nature. There is quite a bit of violence in the book. Do you feel like that is representative of the level of violence in the United States, or do you feel like you exaggerated a bit? What are your feelings about your depictions of it?
Well, violence in the United States is very polar. There's this public violence of the mass shootings,
mm-hmm.
because we have a multifaceted problem of one, very efficient firearms that can shoot 30 rounds in 30, well, more like 45 to 60 seconds. So those firearms can kill many, many people quickly. And we have no universal health care. We have very poor mental health care system. So there's also the aspect of mental health care, and there's no access to mental health care if you don't have insurance, and you can't have insurance usually if you don't have a job. But if you're not mentally well, then how do you have a job to have health insurance to get mental health care?
Right.
And so you have this cyclical issue with mental health care while simultaneously having access to amazingly efficient weapons. Now, I want to make it clear that I'm not the kind of person that's saying we should take every gun from everybody. However, I do not think that you need a semi-automatic rifle that can shoot 30 fucking rounds out of a magazine that holds 30 rounds and then put another 30 round magazine into it. I think that's ludicrous. I personally am a hunter and I use a bolt action rifle to hunt. And that's pretty much the extent of my firearm usage. I don't really have the kind of, like, that just, they don't have the kind of allure to me just as a thing. I just like eating wild game, and that's, it's like a hammer. You know, I need to drive a nail or I need to harvest a deer. I use the tool, I put the tool up. So you've got those two combinations. That's the public violence. And it's on the TV every day, and we have more public mass shootings than any other country in the world. And I think about it a lot when I'm out. I think about it when I'm at the gym. I think about it when I'm at a restaurant. Is this the day that somebody who hasn't had access to mental health care but access to 400,000 guns that they can probably just pick up from somebody's house without them even knowing, because they're behind every damn door in everybody's house around here? I mean, I see guns when I'm out on people's person, like walking around, which is insane to people in other countries. Like, I saw somebody with a pistol in Target today when I was getting my wife's medication. Then you have your private violence, which is the violence that happens between family members and people who are in a relationship with one another. And I think both have similar factors. And I think both are a representation of a bit of the rot that we have in this country when it comes with our willingness to do something about problems, because both have mental health aspects and harm reduction steps need to be taken to limit access to weapons that are super efficient or weapons in the hands of people who absolutely just don't need to have them at all. So that leads us to the level of violence we have. We have violence that is a more consequential, usually because of the ability to create the amount of havoc. And we have people who are living paycheck to paycheck because they have no advocacy to
Right.
help themselves economically like we used to. And part of our economy runs on the idea of having people who are economically unstable. And it's almost expected. And if you look through the history of the United States, we started off, I say we, well, we, it was, it's my country, started off with chattel slavery by stealing people from Africa. Then, of course, keeping said same people in a subservient role with Jim Crow and lower wages, which is the reason we have the tipping economy in the US. I don't have time to explain it, but look it up. And then, of course, we have workers from China who came and worked for damn near nothing to build our railroad system. Then, of course, now we have laborers who come from South America and Central and Mexico, Central America, South America, Mexico, and who work for damn near nothing, just like the laborers in China did, or from China did for the railroad. And when you put people in a position of abject poverty, they become desperate. And I'm not saying that the people from that are in these groups are desperate. I'm saying that that's a representation of we want cheap to free labor. We want to create a class, whether they what no matter what their immutable characteristics are, usually not white though, that have this unstable environment, and that unstable environment leads to mental health issues, and mental health issues lead to detrimental outcomes, not just for them, their family, which is the private violence, which then eventually spills over into the public violence. Of course, that is not a guaranteed thing. That is, that something that happens terrible in the home is going to spill over, or that people who have violence done against them are going to do violence. But these series of events happen so much, we're talking millions, that inevitably that ends up. Can you hear Siri talking to me?
I could not. No.
Or can you still hear me?
I can still hear you, but I can't hear Siri, so.
Okay, good, good, good. Siri, stop. Okay. So that private violence leads into the public violence with no mitigation laws to mitigate the issues and the availability of these insane weapons. And that's something that doesn't happen with the regularity it does in other Western democracies. Other Western democracies have the same problems we have, but they've taken some steps to harm reduction, whereas we are gridlocked and incapable of doing so. And I highly doubt that we will be able to do so, so it will continue on. But I go throughout my day on a day-to-day basis without seeing violence, typically. But it is set to burst out in any minute. So, I don't think that any country is more or less inherently violent or primed towards violence. It's all the environment that you put millions of people in and kind of mix up and see what comes out. You know,
and I think it's partially. I think following up on that, it's also part of the idea of, you know, even if people are as prone to violence, let's, you know, people are equal, let's say these groups of people, right, that are violent exist in every country, but sure. The opportunity to act on that violence is very different, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the tools used to prevent it or to mitigate it are different. And the results of what happens afterwards and the things that happened before will not look exactly the same.
No. Yeah, we, like Australia, was they had a really terrible mass shooting and they did something about it. But the United States government is very unique in a way, the way the bicameral Senate works or bicameral Congress, and the way our electoral system works with the Electoral College and the fact that someone can lose the election but win the election. What a lot of people around the world need to understand is that the majority of Americans don't like what's going on with the types of weapons that are available, the lack of health care and mental health care. They want something done. But there's just no way to come to any kind of consensus for some reason. And I don't see that fading away until, this is going to sound very mean, until there's a generational shift and some of the older generation passes away of old age. And even then, I think because of the bicameral Congress, where you have states like Wyoming with 500,000 people, senators, versus a state like California with 40 million people and they have two senators, probably won't resolve that issue either. Or if you look at our Supreme Court, 9 justices, 5 of which were nominated by presidents who lost the majority election. They lost the election, but won the election and had the right to put someone in a position to do things like overturn Roe v. Wade, which most Americans don't want again. You can see that if you look at Kansas, they put it to a vote to outlaw abortion completely. Kansas, one of the most conservative states in the union, said no by popular vote. It just kind of shows you how kind of loopy our system is. And I think that system worked really well when they didn't have means of quick communication, you know, where you had to take the results of the election to Washington on horseback, but it doesn't work anymore. Or when we had 13 states instead of 50.
Right. The scales look quite a bit different nowadays than it was back then.
It doesn't scale up well. It doesn't scale up well at all, because it gives outsized power to a handful of people in very rural states. And not that those people shouldn't have power, but they shouldn't have any more or less power than anyone else. That's just like my opinion. But there's plenty of people that would disagree with me. And usually they're the people that want to make sure that everybody can have all these insane guns and think that going to a psychologist is voodoo, basically. Or they'll use it as a blanket excuse, like, it's a mental health issue. Okay, it's a mental health issue. Wait, do you think that just means you can wash your hands of it? mental health issue, a private mental health issue, because a public health problem when people get ventilated by, you know, lead in the street. So, yeah, it does become your problem. So do I think that, well, no, I don't think we're inherently, it's inherently more or less violent. I think the weapons of violence are insanely efficient.
Right. And so you think that the result of the violence, it's enabled more, but the violence level itself is not any different.
Right. And I think that if you look at, it's the unease, economic unease to some degree, and it's not all of our society. But there's a good portion that are purposefully kept uncomfortable. And when they lose their job, they lose their health care and likely their housing. If they have a gun, they've lost every little bit of power they have in their lives, and they're about to go live in their car. And a lot of, sometimes they turn around and open fire on everyone at their job. And no one talks about that aspect either. It's the economic insecurity mixed with the mental health issues bred by not having the economic ability to seek mental health care.
Right.
And of course, you say, well, the guns cost money, right?
Yeah. And it's a very systemic issue, right?
Your cousin probably has one behind his door. You could go steal it. So. I know. That's some heavy shit, man. It's kind of depressing. Yeah, it's scary too, because it's a real thing. Like, I really do worry about mass shootings on a daily basis.
I think it is a sad reality right now in the United States, and with what's going on, you know, the politics and everything, that it's a difficult situation, and it's a very systemic problem. So it's not something that can just be easily changed by a couple of people. It's something that has to be, a lot of things need to be overhauled to really truly fix the root cause, rather than to, you know, just answer symptoms. But answering some of the symptoms, at least a start to mitigating how bad the explosions of violence are, and then working on the systems while working on the symptoms, is kind of like the best way to do about it. But
yeah,
it's going to take a while before that actually fully
goes
forward. If it does,
I don't think I'll see it in my lifetime. I really just don't.
Yeah.
I have very little confidence, not in my fellow man or my fellow countrymen. And I say that man is in the general species.
Yeah.
I have doubt in the way our government is structured. And that doesn't even have anything to do with anybody alive today.
Right.
So.
And so going into this, you know, your writing touches on these types of topics, right? And your writing can be described as, we think of your writing as transgressive, right?
Right.
And would you say that that's very intentional, that you actively are, de-identify as a transgressive writer, and that you talk about these topics as an active choice?
I guess so. I've never really thought about it. So John Milton was called, well, he was called a polemic, as basically like his job title, right? He described it as that one time. And I feel like that's a writer's job, is to be not necessarily a firebrand, but to shine a light on things that seem ludicrous or to push social standards. Now, if you want to hear something really wild, John Milton's my great, 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 great uncle. That's true. I found that out years ago, doing some family tree thing, and I was like, well, that makes sense. but I kind of feel like whatever tiny bit of genes or came over from his brother, who is my super duper great grandfather, like fuel that need to do something like that, which is to buck the trend, but not for the purpose of. Some people do it for the shock value, and that's the wrong reason. Like, you do it for a reason. You point out injustice.
Right.
If everything is rolling fine, you know, I'm not out here going, I hate vanilla ice cream. Fuck everybody who hates vanilla ice cream. You know, like, what would the point be? You know what I mean? Because there's nothing wrong with vanilla ice cream. Right. It's a, but pointing out, like, hey, you're killing people by doing this, or you're harming people by doing this. Oh, it hurts your feelings that I told you that? Fucking care? I'm going to tell you that harder and with more force now.
Right.
So if that's what a transgressive writer is or polemic is, then fuck yeah, count me in. Then yes, I do it on purpose. I mean, it comes from being a punk rock kid, you know? I'm doing it, and that's what attracted me to that as a kid, as a young man, is we are saying there's something wrong. There's never going to be a utopia. We're not waiting for this magical world to appear like the hippies did. We want some fucking truth, and we want to try to do better. We know we're not going to do perfect. We know we're not going to make a utopia, but we want to try better, do better, want to be better to each other. We want to point out the terrible things and try to do something about it.
Right.
But I don't raise hell just to raise hell.
Yeah, I think that's a very valid view of it. And I think that part of what I personally enjoy about your writing is that while it does go into some very heavy and like hard topics, and it can be difficult, you know, to grasp and tackle them, you do it in a way that still is with the humanity of the characters and the readers in mind while you're doing it. And I feel like that's something that doesn't get lost in your writing, where I feel like, as you mentioned, some people are just kind of doing it for the shock value. In those cases, the humanity behind it does feel lost to me, right?
Right.
And so I personally connect with your writing from the perspective of, hey, this is a very human experience, even if it's not a happy one.
Well, I really appreciate that. Thank you.
It's no problem. I do think that core of your writing is there consistently across both of the books that I've read, both Prophet's Day and Prophet's Lamentation. And I want to change gears a bit, because we've been doing kind of a heavy topic. We've been covering some pretty heavy topics just to kind of make things a little bit lighter. Recently, you've been doing some readings, right, from Prophet's Day and from Prophet's Lamentation, and you've been reading passages from these books to people in the noir at the bar scene. Yep. How did that come about, and how has it been reading, you know, sections from these books to an audience?
My very first book, which didn't get published, came out in 2015. It really fucking sucked. I don't even bother with it. It's called A Fear Eye, and I took it off the market. It's anyway, I like the idea. Maybe one day I'll rewrite it. But there's this nice gentleman named Samuel Morgan Blinn. Now, Sam runs this zine called Bull Spec, which is Bull City Speculative Fiction, which is out of Durham, which is like Bull Durham. Maybe you not have seen that movie, but we have a baseball team called the Durham Bulls. So it's Bull Speculative Fiction, Bull Spec. He read my first book and kindly nominated me for a Manly Wade Wellman, which I lost, didn't even come close to winning. And he had my email. There's this guy named Eric Pruitt. In fact, I have his new book sitting on top of my computer, half read. It's called Something Bad Wrong. It's really fucking good. You should read it. Eric Pruitt owns this bar called Yonder Bar in Hillsboro, North Carolina, which is not as in the middle of nowhere as it sounds, but it kind of is half to the middle of nowhere. And he's friends with a lot of other really well-known writers. And he puts on these noir bars, and he lost a writer and needed to fill the position. And Sam was kind enough to recommend me to Eric, who owns the bar, almost a year ago. It would have been July, 2 weeks after Prophet's Debt came out. And I went and read a smaller version of chapter one. And I really thought I would have been nervous, but I wasn't. And as I had honed this down and read it, and, you know, I wrote it, and these are like my people, you know, like these are the literary nerds who really appreciate a story and some strange stories. Right. And it was very well received. And a lot of people bought the book from me. There are a couple of fairly well-known writers who asked me for copies of the book. Like, I signed for them, and these people that like I really respected beforehand and consider quote unquote famous, maybe to me, maybe not to everybody, but and they've read and enjoyed my work. And it's a real hoot to even think about that being the case. And because they like my work, I started getting invites to other ones. So I came back for another noir bar in Hillsboro. And I did my own noir bar in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, and I'm doing another one this summer. And then I got invited to New York City to do a noir bar, which I feel like I totally bombed, but a lot of other people say I didn't bomb it or whatever. But you have to understand, I'm from the middle of nowhere. I'm in the middle of nowhere right now. And I've never been to New York, and I've never been to a city that large. And it was a bit overwhelming. And I met some people like who are straight up like heroes, like people who are now in their one specific man who's now in his 70s, who worked with Robert Redford, who has just had a TV series out, and, you know, like somebody I really admire. And I'm like standing there talking to him, someone I've known about my entire life. And like, he's this larger than life figure, and there he is. You know, you don't get those kind of opportunities every day. And it's rattling. And it took me a long time to find the bar because I'd get on the subway and all of that. And I think that being that was my fourth, I'm trying to think if I did another one. I think it was my fourth reading. It was actually my stiffest and most strained reading. My first one, not so much. So, but also I go to the events as well, because now a lot of these people I consider my friends. And also because there are a lot of people in the audience who've read my books. And I go and I, you know, even if I'm not reading, you know, I go and talk to them. I went to Richmond 2 weeks ago to go to one. I'm not reading there, but I went there. And just to meet people. Like I met a couple of great people while I was there in Richmond. And, you know, I'm not going to name drop and all this because, you know, it's not really my place, except for Eric, because it's Eric's bar and, you know, and Sam. But it's just been humbling to the level of acceptance, because a lot of us are very like-minded, but I'm not of really any note per se, like most of these people are, but they don't treat me that way. They're always kind, accepting, and giving me advice. And it's just been like, you know, you find your people, you know. It's kind of like, right, when I first found like The Clash, And then, like, I went to punk rock shows and found people who also liked those kind of bands and had the same ideas that I had, and political ideas and non-traditional lives, and just seeing this other world. It's kind of like that again, you know, as an adult.
It's funny, your tribe.
Yeah. And those tribes cross over, kind of like the queer community and the punk community definitely cross over. You know, a lot of people, I don't think, realize that, but it's one of the few places that you could be a gay person and out, is like in the punk rock scene. You know? Nobody fucking cared. If they do, then they're not going to be there very long. So, yeah, it's kind of like that.
So you've been doing these readings and going to these events and such, and you've had it sounds like you've been enjoying your interactions with your fans, people who have read your writing, and these other authors. And with that, you mentioned, you know, your most recent reading in New York was probably your stiffest. Would you say that it was because you felt a certain level of perhaps some pressure from seeing these other authors that you've known and looked up to?
Yeah, specifically the man he's in his 70s, who's, like I said, he's been there my entire life. Most of the other writers, the thing a lot of people don't get is they're like, oh man, so-and-so, don't ever give up. He got published at 45. Like, that's pretty normal, actually. Like, most people get published between their mid-30s and mid-40s for the first time. So, you know, a lot of the people I know that are well-known are about 10 years older than me, maybe 8 to 10 years older than me most of the time. So they were where I am now as far as public perception, where I am at this time. But to see somebody whose movies were playing on television when I was a child, already in syndication, he's a living legend, and you're reading in front of him, that's tough.
Yeah, I can imagine just the amount of pressure you can put on, be like, I want to do really well because I want to represent myself well to this person that I've looked up to, right?
Yeah. So, but with the other guys and gals, so it tends to be guys, because I think we don't tell our young women, we don't encourage them to write as much as we do men, and we should. They're closer in my age range, so they're not as intimidating to me. I don't know why that is, but because of that, they're just less intimidating, so I'm less kind of seized up, even though they're, like I said, of very much of note, unlike myself. So
I think you're of note. I think you've got your name out there. Obviously there's different levels to, you know, how well you're known and such, but I think that you're reading your readers, right? The people who have read your work and enjoy it do exist, right? You do have a fan base.
Ooh.
That
I do, and they're fucking fantastic.
And with that fan base, right? Included in that fan base is we have a PR list, right? And we have people from the PR list who have read Prophet's Lamentation who haven't read Prophet's Debt and are asking, hey, could I read Prophet's Debt after having read Prophet's Lamentation? And with that kind of, you know, Prophet's Debt is the first book and Prophet's Lamentation is the second book, but they're going the other way around. Do you feel like it's important to read the books in a certain order, or?
Nope. Not these two.
For these, you feel good with people reading them either way.
Either way. And so the thing is with sequels, the further you get into it, so I've got three books in the series. When you get to the third one, and I'm trying to do my best because I'm in the middle of writing it. I'm probably a third of the way through with Prophet's Death. It's very difficult to write something that far removed from the beginning and make it stand alone. But as far as the two that are out, or about to be out a couple of days. You can read them either way. And I kind of like to think about Prophet's Death when compared to Prophet's Lamentation, is that you can read Prophet's Lamentation where you watch the first Star Wars trilogy. So the ones from the 70s and 80s. You know there's a Clone War, you know all that stuff, but you don't need to see it. You don't want to. And I think of Prophet's Death as the prequel. If you want the origin story and the nitty-gritty, you can go read it, but you don't have to if you can't stomach it, which some people can. And that's completely understandable. It's harsh. Like I said, people have thrown up, and a lot of people cry. There's a lot of crying. If you've been abused, it's going to hurt.
Yeah.
That's the politest way to put it. I mean, but if you're really into horror, then yeah. One of my favorite reviews is a 1-star review. It says, this book is an unmitigated horror fest. It is... what I did not expect was the rest to be, rest of the book being full throttle gratuitous violence. Well, that they were talking about the beginning where there was the beginning where it was horrible things happened to Naomi. But then when we get to the part where the horrible things are done happen to Naomi, I relish and love the violence that she enacts on all of the motherfuckers who have it coming. So it's a real treat for someone to say the rest of the book is full throttle gratuitous violence. Thank you. It is. And there's a good reason for it.
Yeah. And so with that, you know, the people reading it and giving you their feedback, right? Both, you know, positive, negative reviews, and, you know, talking with other writers and having a fan base that you interact with, has that affected the way that you've been approaching writing your stories? Did it affect how you wrote Prophet's Lamentation, or how you're writing your next book in the series, Prophet's Death, or is it not affecting it so much?
Not at all. I mean, if you've read my work, it's some freaky shit. There's no way that I'm toning that down, because by now, if you're a fan, you know what to expect from me. And if I were to throttle it, that wouldn't be me. If I were to worry about what other people think and write for them, I'm writing for a committee and not for me. Now, I do write for other people to make them feel seen. I write for other people to give them hope, because that is the universal theme. And it might be difficult to see when you begin reading some of it, is that the purpose of all of this is to give people hope. So if I can do that, and if those things line up, what the audience wants and the hope can line up, then they luckily get what they want. But I will never write to appease. Which is pretty apparent whoever's listening to this, when you go out and you will go out and buy my book and read it, you will see that that is definitely not the case. And that is the death knell to any creative process, whether it be painting, writing, singing, playing music, is to play to an audience. And that's how you get the shallow, washed out shit that, you know, it's everywhere, mainstream music and literature, you know, basically stuff that says nothing. It doesn't talk about the human character. It doesn't talk about the human condition. It doesn't talk about trials and tribulations. It's like eating Lay's chips. It's garbage, garbage, garbage. Let me just see another. Let me just see another. Let me just see another. That's the same thing with streaming. And not that every show on TV is bad, not that every movie is bad, not that all books are bad. Most are actually pretty, most are okay. But,
right.
You know, when you're talking about like playing to an audience, and you're toning it down for them, then it does become shit. So
yeah,
I'll
definitely.
Never do that.
I have experienced that with some books where I felt like, or some stories, content that I've watched and such, where I felt like it was going in such a dark direction and I was here for it, and then they just suddenly pulled back on me. What is this?
Yeah, originality requires a peculiarity and also just not caring that someone else thinks that it's terrible, because they will.
I think different people have different tastes and such, and that will happen.
Sure.
But
sure.
For you and your writing process, right? You've been solidly confident in writing the story as you see it, and putting that onto the page and getting people to experience and letting people experience it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so across writing, you know, profits, debt, and profit segmentation, have you found that you've had any big takeaways in terms of your development as a writer, or do you feel like you've been pretty much the same? What has your experience been with that?
It's practice. Being a published writer has given me reason to write, which has given me practice. When I first began with Profits Debt, it wasn't called Profits Debt. It was really just an idea, and I spent several years kind of working on it, and the way I wrote it isn't the form you see now. Mm-hmm. And when I started working with Christopher is, I think, when I really started to become starting to learn to be a good writer, to write in the way that works for someone else who's not me to read, because I wrote it for me. And the process of spending those months rewriting Profits Debt, I think, is what's partially made me the writer. I had the capacity for it. I had the education. But really, it was that exercise for those, I think it's about half a year it took me to become the writer I am. And of course, I rewrote it twice after. And then it's just, from then on, it's just practice. You know, having written another full-length book, I practice while I'm writing, and then I rewrite. So all those hours spending in this in process and making my brain come up with creative ideas and being able to delegate whether those are good ideas or not, especially having Christopher tell me they're not, and then trying to internalize that, because Christopher's usually right. And I'll say that because that Christopher is the publisher, but because Christopher has a really keen understanding of what the audience sees and how to give the audience what you're trying to say in a package that they can understand from the get-go,
right?
Which is something I was not doing well at that time, which I still struggle with. Like, the finished product you see in the book is not, you know, it's not, you know, what comes out in the beginning.
Oh yeah.
So it's just
sure.
That practice, and forcing myself to be creative, forcing myself to write a certain way, and constantly judging myself. This is probably why writers have a lot of depression issues.
Yeah, I think if you're constantly having to, you know, sort of build something up only to tear it apart again, that can take its toll, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't know if it's the chicken or the egg thing, is it? Depression has a certain play inside your neurology that's non-related to your creativity. But there's neurological presets are somehow immutable to one another, because they're all, like, writers on average twice the sounds bad, but it usually it's around twice the suicide rate of the normal population published writers. It's not coming from that, but what I'm saying is there's definitely a connection to self-critical that goes into the ability to become a good writer, as long as you don't languish into self-criticism and just try to make it better.
Right. And so, you know, you've gone through this process of writing two books now with that are being published. Well, one of them's already published. One's about to be released for the public to buy and read. And with these experiences, you know, you say you've developed mostly practice for your writing skills and, you know, more honing your craft, right? For those people out there who are aspiring to become authors, who are aspiring to become writers, what would be a piece of advice that you'd want to give them to kind of help them along their path with that?
I'm going to give you the same advice that kind of came to my head when I was doing my last interview, which is don't listen to the haters, even the ones in your own head.
I think that's a good piece of advice.
Right, exactly. You should listen to your own criticism and try to fix what you think needs fixing. But this self-hatred in saying that it's never going to be better, everything's always going to be like this, coming from your own self, is normal and natural. But if you wallow in it, you know, it's you're never going to advance as a writer. And if you listen to people and write what they want to hear, just like you're saying, writing to an audience, you'll also fail because you're not being you. And art is a personal expression.
I think that's wonderful advice and beautiful guidance for aspiring authors, you know, to find that balance between being self-critical and accepting the development of your work rather than feeling like it's lost, and, you know, being capable of hearing what people say but not letting it determine your path for your creativity.
That's right. And hell, I'm still an aspiring author. Come on.
Hey, you say that, but you're about to have your second book published, so
yeah, that's true.
But, you know, there's levels to aspiring author. You're still aspiring to further writing and greater honing of your craft. And I think that
I'm going to.
Go ahead.
My goal is to write a book every year until I die. But I'm going to try. That's my aspiration. I'm definitely nowhere near death, so I'm sure that something will come up one day.
And for now, though, I'd like to thank you for talking with me today and for being on the Writer's Triangle. And I'm really excited for the release of Prophet Cementation. I know your fans are, too. And so thank you for coming on.
Thank you for having me, Rasta.
And to everybody listening, you know, thank you to all of our beautiful moms for checking in, tuning into the Writer's Triangle. Be sure to buy Prophet Cementation, available everywhere books are sold, coming out this upcoming Tuesday. Real quick, Rob, can you share with everybody where they can find you as far as social media?
I lost my first Twitter account because I told Elon Musk that The Matrix was a trans allegory and didn't belong to him. And so now I have a new one. It's Author Creekmore. So like a novelist, Author Creekmore on Twitter. All one word, Author Creekmore.
Okay, wonderful. Thank you for coming on, and thank you everybody for listening. Be sure to visit centeredbymouth.com to check out the transcripts. We'll also have the links to Rob's Twitter and for links to Prophet's Lamentation and Prophet's Debt. Once again, Rob, thank you for coming on today. It's been wonderful having you.
Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.